Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to the folks from Drilling Mora County about the realities of oil and gas extraction that are proposed in that part of New Mexico. I'm very happy now to welcome John McPhee. He is an expert in safety planning, policy, and programs. He is a member of the Santa Fe Alliance for Public Health and Safety. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
Now, the reason we are talking today is that on Wednesday, the 10th of March at 7 o'clock, the Santa Fe City Council will meet and they will be voting on whether to adopt a new citywide telecommunications ordinance that provides for franchise agreements, which sounds really bureaucratic and technical, but it actually has the potential to have a very great effect on the citizens of Santa Fe. Let's go back for a moment and start with the 1996 telecommunications ordinance, which had a lot of provisions about what cities are and aren't allowed to do in terms of things like cell phone towers and stuff like that.
Exactly. What it was, in 96, they actually, I think, were really didn't have any concept of how large the telecommunications industry would become. They had no concept of how many of us would fall in love with cell phones, laptops, and so forth. And they just wanted to foster and encourage private development. So they said there would be no health and safety considerations at the local level in the placement of wireless technology. They were concerned about it. It is an immediate red flag that they know more than they're telling.
And yeah, I was going to say, when somebody says there will be no health and safety considerations under any circumstances, you think, well, are there health and safety considerations? And that's a big, huge question.
It's a huge question that has not been answered. And they keep saying there's no fire. And I just tell people, frankly, I'm gagging on the smoke. Between the deception, the misinformation, the disregard for non-industry studies, it goes on and on and on. And frankly, when I started reading the Telecommunications Act, I became really incensed, really kind of outraged that I'd spent my entire career on health and safety specifically for children, and that suddenly something that, I mean, we know that electrical workers, for example, have had some of the highest rates of cancer for 30, 40 years. Why on earth would there be no local authority to have health and safety considerations for the placement of wireless technology? Why wouldn't it fit into all our other planning that we're so detailed about? I mean, it's amazing to me how much more detail we go into on other things.
One of the things that has been a little bit, has raised red flags for me is that there is, on the part of a whole segment of people, what looks to me like paranoia and also a kind of conflation of cell phones, cell phone towers, Wi-Fi, as if they were all one thing and as if they all emitted the same kind of radiation and the same level of radiation, and that they were all just about to kill us. And I don't, you know, what's the, help us sort out the reality of that.
That's really my specialty, is again, in these safety issues, determining, as we hear so much information and so many different perspectives, what are just the facts? The fact of the matter is that there's a number of different kinds of radiation in different kinds of technology, and it's all moving so rapidly that it's actually, even the research is a moving target as the technology is changing even every year. But I think the panic is, among a number of people, is that there are people getting electrical sensitivity. In the first signs of that would be insomnia and ringing in the ears, primarily. That's the ringing in the ears was identified actually in the 60s as the Frey effect. Alan Frey of Cornell University, doing a study there actually with funding from the Navy, determined that there was that you actually could hear radar and so forth, and that you weren't actually hearing it through your eardrums, but it would be an interaction actually in your brain. It caused a lot of controversy in the neuro science field, but he managed to keep plodding along, and he was disregarded. But then suddenly another well-known scientist, Dr. Henry Lay of Washington State University, replicated his non-thermal effect on the brain.
Now, what was affecting the brain? What were the actual stimuli?
The stimuli is actually radiation itself.
What kind of radiation?
That's a good question. Is I don't know which kind of radiation he was using, but it was the radiation that was that we see strongest in radar, mostly around airports, obviously, but it's very similar to the radiation that, that now emits from cell towers and from antennas and microwave relays. What Frey found and Dr. Lay found was that he could very easily replicate or determine what was happening in the brain because he did test on rats. Unfortunately, rats have actually very similar brains to humans. And he just simply put dye in their blood and immediately noticed that there was a breakdown of the barrier between the circulatory system and the brain. This was... He did it very, very evident. You know,
when rats were stimulated with radar.
With radar and radiation of any kind. I mean, the radiation that was similar to what we're using now. It's transposed so many times because, of course, even at that point, the cell phone wasn't even invented. But he did start out working very hard on this, on looking at the radar. And then it evolved. So Dr. Lay and Dr. Frey accomplished this, and what was exciting from that point is then the EPA was organized in 1970, and they went right ahead and started a whole team that were working on radiation issues, and they got great money, and they did wonderful work. And the exciting thing for me is amazing is a lot of the people who actually started out on this team in 1970 are still working in the field 40 years later. It's amazing to me. I can go talk to them on the phone, and they will tell me everything in detail as to what happened.
Interesting. So we've got some of the same people working on issues of radiation coming from whatever it be. I mean, television and radio waves going
Absolutely.
Through the air are a type of radiation.
Mm-hmm.
The kind of frequencies that are used for cell phones and so on. Are there health and safety standards at this point around those types of radiation?
Yes, there are. But unfortunately, the standards they adopted were those of the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers, which was basically an industry represented group, and they disregarded the very professional and much more strict safety standards that the EPA recommended in 1992. Those were disregarded. And apparently, I noticed just something today, they said they thought they were still on the website, which I don't know whether they are or not. I've got to find them.
The EPA, the EPA recommendations.
Exactly. The EPA, I think, was so frustrated that they went ahead, the group that had worked on this for so many years, some of these people had already worked on this 20 years, and then were disregarded. And they said FCC is going to regulate this. FCC adopted, you know, these regulations from basically an industry group. So informally, the EPA scientists continued to meet and continued to consult with them and kept giving them information. But they did not get very far except to, I think, prevent them from even weakening the standards further from what was originally recommended. I couldn't figure out why we had gotten to this point where here we are in the city, not allowed to consider safety issues and basic planning. You know, I've been in zoning and planning for safety all my life in the Park Service, construction, now in the Health Department. Never seen such constraints on a city to do their own planning. And where it came from, I finally determined, I've been still digging, is that the military was involved. They were uncomfortable with the standards that the EPA wanted. So it was really a collaboration of private industry desires for their streamlining their operations and higher profit, because there's tremendous profit involved with going wireless as opposed to being wired, as opposed to having the regulations that they constrain the military and prevent them from doing what they want to do.
Well, there's a parallel in the oceans. There has been a tremendous battle to regulate the use of Navy sonar, which actually kills whales.
Exactly.
And they basically want to have the freedom to do whatever they want if it involves military communications or even the possibility to do military communications. Same thing, no doubt, true here on land.
Exactly. You just nailed it. That the military has been involved with this for many, many years. Like I said, they funded the original work that Alan Frey did in 1960. But they already, you know, very, very rapidly, when they found out that Alan Frey was able to determine that there was permeation of the blood barrier between the brain and circulatory system from radiation exposure, they basically stopped funding his work. That was the end of that. Dr. Lay in Washington was working, I think, for Motorola, trying to vindicate their wireless technology they were inventing. And when they found out he replicated the damaging effects that Dr. Frey had seen, they also stopped his work and told him not to publish.
So this is a big cover-up story.
Oh, my God. It's amazing. It's just the more every page I turn, there's another twist to it, another person involved. Apparently, the pivotal moment was when Reagan came in 1980, and by 1982, that's when the EPA had already lost most of their funding. Even though they didn't present, I'm still trying to, as I interview people from all over the country, trying to get the sequence of events proper. But it seems that, they didn't. They even though they stopped their funding basically in 1982, they continued with very limited funding to provide those recommendations to FCC in 1992. Had them disregarded, had industry standards adopted. And then we proceeded into the 96 Telecommunications Act, and I saw a figure yesterday. They thought that somewhere in the neighborhood of $50 million of lobbying was required to get Section 704 of the Telecommunications Act put in there to say there will be no health and safety considerations. It was quite amazing to me, and I'd never seen a piece of federal legislation that blatantly and explicitly stated to ignore health and safety considerations.
So we are talking to John McPhee. He is an expert in safety planning, policy, and programs. He's from the Santa Fe Alliance for Public Health and Safety. What can we... I mean, we could talk about cover-ups all day long, and there are so many cover-ups in the history of our nation, even just in the last 30 years.
Oh, absolutely.
That said, putting that aside for a moment, let's talk about actual health and safety. There are non-industry studies. There are these studies that you just mentioned about the circulatory system, blood-brain barrier. There are other studies that, although they've been ignored and although they haven't been become part of policy, they do exist. What do they tell us?
The principal one that I thought was the most interesting that would most replicate the situation we have now. My big concern is, just like with chemicals, there's very, very little research done on the synergistic effect of many multiple exposures from multiple locations. The safety standards are based on single exposures of an adult male, adult male or female, but a large head. Not even any studies as to what it would do to children.
Right.
And they're starting to get very concerned about that. The principal one that got my attention, and I just saw it yesterday, was Dr. Ole Johansson of Sweden. He and a partner determined that in the 5 years following the basic building of the infrastructure to accommodate cell phones in Sweden in 1997, the next 5 years they saw a continuing sudden turn to the negative in terms of health outcomes for the local populaces in every county in Sweden.
What kinds of health outcomes?
While sick days had basically been declining for a couple of decades among workers, they doubled in the next 5 years. After the first 5 years after they started putting together a whole infrastructure of antennas, microwave links, and cell towers. And everybody started adopting and using cell phones on an everyday basis. They also suddenly it doubled the use of antidepressants during that period as well. Those are two indicators that they came forward with. I thought that was very interesting and I'd never seen. And the Karolinska Institute, for those who don't know, they're the ones that award the Nobel Prize in Medicine. And these people are not messing around. Ole Johansson's a phenomenally committed person, as is Dr. Leif Safran, also of Sweden. They've worked on this field for 30 years. Safran, in fact, continued Frey's work and Lai's work from the 70s about blood barrier penetration, again replicating exactly what the same outcomes they got, which were not good in terms of using the cell phone too much. What we've gotten to now, fortunately, the breakthrough this year and tremendous relief as we go to the city council meeting next week is that a number of cities and municipalities in California have basically defied the FCC edict to get in there and do franchise agreements and so forth and so on. The franchise agreement being wholesale permission for private industry to put antennas and cell towers wherever they feel like as they need, not in with no consideration of health and safety for the local populace or for schools, daycares, rec centers, or residential areas.
So basically, there are cities that, in defiance of the 1996 Telecommunications Act, are saying, no, if you want to put a cell phone tower in our city, you have to follow the following X, Y, and Z regulations.
Right.
And this has actually happened and has not been challenged?
It's incredible. It's all happening so quickly that it's a moving target. We're still waiting to see if one of them might be sued. We're still trying to interview those lawyers.
Was it San Diego?
San Diego. And San Diego has wonderful provisions. And our team has done this incredible job of commingling portions of the San Diego ordinance with two others, I think Irvine, California, and some others, as a place to start with developing the ordinance we need to protect the populace in Santa Fe. This time last year, if those ordinances had been in place, those cities might have been sued. Somehow, there was a release of a major study in mid-August about cell phones that was summarizing the research and showing a lot of very basic concern on very professional, based on professional research from all over the world. And subsequently, there was hearings this fall, which were quite disturbing to the Congress regarding health dangers. And then mysteriously, suddenly in November, comes out wireless devices and health concerns on the FCC website. They're very carefully worded as to say we're not committing to the fact that science is proving that this stuff is dangerous. But if you want to follow the precautionary principle, you might want to do the following, and they have a whole protocol for that anybody can find on the FCC website.
What are some of the things on that protocol?
Using an earpiece and headset for your cell phone. Keep wireless devices away from your body, not putting them on your belts or in your pockets when they're on. Use a cell phone speaker to reduce exposure to the head. In other words, even if you just speak a few inches in front of your face as opposed to right on your ear and on your jaw, apparently it's significantly safer.
Well, one of the things that, and we could get a scientist on the show at some point to talk about the numbers with this, but the amount of radiation that you're exposed to drops off very rapidly.
Yes.
The further away the device is from your head, and the same is true of cell phone towers.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So if you have a cell phone tower on what? On the top of a tall building and nobody is working anywhere near the top three floors or something, which is, I suppose, unlikely. But in other words, if it's just far enough away from people,
exactly,
it's much less dangerous. Do we have, are there numbers, are there guidelines about that?
There are guidelines, and I find them so confusing, and I don't think, in addition to designing this new ordinance, which again, we're just going to ask the city to go to individual site review and all these aspects they have in California, which is just normal protocol in any other aspect of safety. You evaluate each site. I'd love to have an inventory of what's already in the city. This whole attitude where we have to rush to something, we're missing out on something. My estimates are that we already are servicing 60,000 cell phones in the city, plus probably 20,000 laptops.
That's the population of the whole city.
The metropolitan area is 125,000. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Including the county.
I'm sorry, yeah. In the metropolitan area is about 120,000. And so I'm estimating at any time 60,000 cell phones are probably owned and operating in the city, in the county, I'm sorry, and using, again, right outside the city, so they'd be transmitting off the same cell towers that we have. My concern is, you know, the city says, well, there hasn't been any cell tower applications for 4 or 5 years, but I live on West Alameda, and the cell tower right above me, I've watched it continue to add more and more contraptions every single few months. It just gets more
so
and more loaded.
So that's not a new cell tower, but it's a continually growing and presumably putting out more actual radiation.
Yeah, and I want to know, you know, and I've got to call Washington. Apparently they have applications for all this and whatnot and for each site and whatnot. But I'm not convinced at all that they have any grasp of all these different aspects and places. I mean, all the public agencies now have them on. There's a number of churches in town that now have antennas. That you know, the scary thing is the private sector can be very persuasive in offering you substantive amounts of money a month just to rent your rooftop. And this has happened all over the East Coast. And it's basically...
Yeah, churches and so on are renting their... They're
exactly.
steeples, I suppose.
Oh, yeah. And lucrative contracts to public agencies. Look, you know, we're going to take over and do your whole infrastructure, but we can pay you this and that. And in our, you know, budgetary strain, that looks very appealing to a lot of these local governments. So that's scary, too, is the power of the money. They've got the lawyers. They've got the money to buy rent. They have it all. And we as public agencies are so vulnerable and so limited in what we can do. That's one of the reasons that we went ahead and researched a new ordinance they could use, because the city has just turned over the city attorney. The city attorney is working as fast as he can. The city council has been wonderful in delaying the process and trying to help us out and trying to learn the subject themselves.
Right.
But they're overwhelmed. And we're hoping now, like I said, fortunately, with the fact that they had congressional hearings, and the FCC kind of seemed to back up. They even mentioned the congressional hearing in this list of protocols for safely using cell phones. They seem to are feeling some pushback, some pressure to look at some of the non-industry research a lot closer. And I think that's one reason the FCC is not pushing forward on challenging these ordinances in California, because the climate has changed in Washington.
Right.
It's much more regulatory. And we're starting to tiptoe back from the precipice, as far as I'm concerned, to a reasonable procedure. Like I said, one of the three telecommunications companies planning to operate in Santa Fe released a plan for 87 antennas. Which put out 55 to 85 watts. This is significant amount of radiation.
55 to 85 watts. If you think about a light bulb,
mm-hmm.
that is 55 to 85 watts. It doesn't seem like that much power.
And the problem is it's another kind of watt. And this is what, you know, I wanted to
get another kind of watt.
Yeah. In other words, I didn't want to get into the science because it's quite complex. But it's far more powerful than the light bulb. Yeah, it's extremely powerful, and there's good evidence to the fact that it should not be in the proximity of somebody's home. I'll give you the example. You saw the movie Full Signal.
Right.
They did that very standard epidemiological study there in Palestine and determined that all the incidences of cancers since the antennas were installed in different locations of the city were very specifically right around that antenna.
Were clustered around the antennas.
Just exactly. There wasn't a slight big variation. And that's the concern. They want 87, this one telecommunications company wants to put up 87 antennas in one section of the city.
Right.
Just downtown and northeast. And they may cover like 30,000 people.
Right.
And I don't know, yeah, you said as a sign, I find it so loose compared to the standard we're held to and other safety issues like, you know.
Building code.
Oh my heavens, the building code.
Highway safety.
Exactly. Chemicals. Now, I just came back from the Consumer Product Safety Commission meeting. The standard, the detail of which we go to analyze toys now for plastic contaminations or lead or cadmium, or, you know, they're very detailed regulations, and they've just made them much tighter. And then I come over here to telecommunications, and it just seems extremely loose.
One of the things that is part of the continuing, ongoing conversation is healthcare insurance reform. This is a huge part of healthcare insurance. If it's true that cancers cluster around neighborhoods that have cell phone antennas, the closer they are, the more likely they are. We're causing yet another financial and humanitarian healthcare crisis.
Bingo. Exactly. And the exciting thing is, for people to see the upside, because I know what they're hearing is going to worry people, why I'm involved and where I go to always is, how can we rectify the situation that we created this problem? How can we, you know, really, you know, like I said, it took us 60 years to put a seatbelts in cars. Before, we drove cars for 60 years without seatbelts. Then it took another 30 years for people to wear them. And let's not do that with telecommunications, you know.
Right.
Big concern right now, there was this a research project that came out, the Family Institute Foundation, I've forgotten the exact name, that the average child is now using a cell phone like 800 hours a year.
Yeah, that's one of the things that concerns me most, because children's brains are developing, their skulls are thinner, they love to talk.
Yeah.
And
exactly.
It's very disturbing. And, you know, of the various things that we talk about, one of them that is one thing that's good is that we can control, if we want to, whether our children have cell phones or not. They don't need cell phones.
Right.
You and I both got through childhood intact without cell phones, since they didn't exist. And we can also control whether we and our children use the headsets that and use the speakerphone and things like that.
Exactly.
The cell phone towers is something that's going to be addressed in the city council meeting. There's one more thing I want to make sure that we talk about, and that is there's a lot of fear about Wi-Fi. And when I think, I don't know, what's your take on that?
Well, part of the issue here is that here we have already the infrastructure that many people are able to have pick up Wi-Fi most everywhere. And everyone has a cell phone. There's almost no blank spots left. There's certainly none between Albuquerque and Santa Fe anymore. You know, first of all, why are we rushing for so much more? And what the telecommunications people want to do is basically they want to put up an infrastructure so they can sell the Wi-Fi to every home in America.
Right, but is Wi-Fi dangerous?
That's a continuing question. We do have anecdotal evidence at this point that people suffer from insomnia when they leave the Wi-Fi on at night in their houses. So one thing I'm telling parents is, like, if you have Wi-Fi, just turn it off before you go to bed, you know, and have it off when you're not using it. Don't leave it on 24/7. Just turn it off, because it also affects the people next door. All this electrical stuff is not just simply located to a house. It does affect the neighbors, and they're still trying to explain that to me, and it has effects on electricity. Then there's another issue of dirty electricity. I mean, we have all these buildings all over, and we haven't even begun to address the next dimension of the issue, is that many of these buildings now have, you know, a big commercial building might have 600 or 800 computers in it and equal number of cell phones operating. And it was built originally and designed without any of that in mind. It was previous to even common use of computers. So we have static electricity in addition to the radiation. It all gets quite complex. And my intent is, you know, I do a lot of my work is home safety, is to make sure that I have just some basic protocols like these cell phone ones, like turning off Wi-Fi, that parents don't find complicated, and help them control their fear that, you know, you can control the situation and create an environment that's safe.
We're running out of time, but I want to ask you two things. First of all, how can people really educate themselves on the realities of the dangers, potential dangers? And how can they get involved in Santa Fe's ordinance issues?
Yeah. We're requesting that everybody in the city please call their city councilman and just ask them not to adopt the proposed ordinance with franchise agreements. Simply work with the private sector and city attorney to make an ordinance similar to what is been constructed in San Diego and other municipalities in California that is a traditional lease agreement for individual sites and individual site review. That's the main thing they can do. The second thing we would
and
love...
And this is by this Wednesday.
Yeah, by this Wednesday. Thank you for reminding all of us. And also, we would love to have a show of force on Wednesday night to confirm to the city council. We've had as many as about 100 to 150 people there. We'd love to have 1,000. for people to understand and for the city council to get their attention that this is really serious.
Yeah.
This isn't, we're not, you know, discussing something in historical district. We're talking about the future of the city. We have a wonderful city. We've done incredible things, great projects, and this is something we need to retain. The other issue being it's an economic issue that there are people come here for their health. There's thousands of people come here for their health. We have the best ambient air in the nation. We need to have the best EMF protected zone as well.
And in terms of websites or other places where people can inform themselves about these dangers?
Yeah. I will have handouts. If you come to city council meeting, I will have handouts with websites. But otherwise, I would go to just Google EMFs, electromagnetic field radiation. And there's also a great one called Less EMF, which has a number of new inventions to help protect yourself and neutralize both static electricity and radiation. And the exciting thing is that's exploding science, and I'm hoping that soon we'll have those reviewed by Consumer Reports and have an idea of what is the best thing to buy for your home, for your office, and even your car.
John McPhee is an expert in safety planning, policy, and programs. He's a member of the Santa Fe Alliance for Public Health and Safety. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
I'm very happy now to welcome Kathleen Dudley. She is the co-chair of Drilling Mora County. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte. Pleasure to be on with you.
And the occasion of our conversation today is that this coming Thursday, the 11th of March at 6:30 in the evening, in Mora, there will be an event in which anthropologist Eric Romero will address some of the issues pertaining to natural gas extraction from Mora County and the cultural and environmental issues that are going on there. Give us a little bit of background about Mora County and the issues of drilling for gas in that area.
Well, we're going into our third year now since leases have been signed with both Royal Dutch Shell and their subsidiaries and currently a new corporation called CEJA, C-E-J-A, who holds leasing in the Tucumcari Basin. And so those two drilling companies are interested in developing leasing natural gas in Mora County. And in 2009, during a public hearing, a Shell representative spoke to our commission and to the citizens who attended and stated that they would begin their development in the year 2010. So in Mora County, we are now in 2010, along with everyone else, and we are working to be proactive in keeping this from happening in our county.
I saw this film, Split a State, which perhaps some of our listeners have seen, and if they haven't, it's definitely worth watching, which addressed this whole issue of people who own the surface of their land, but they don't own the mineral rights underneath. Is that an issue in Mora County?
Yes, it is. In fact, we have taken polls at our meetings and asked people if they own their mineral rights. In Mora County, many of the people do not know if they own their mineral rights, and there are many situations where people do not own them. In the case of the leases that have been signed are actually on private property. So KHL Landmen, who made the original purchases or leasing of mineral rights, leased from private mineral owners who actually were in possession of their mineral rights. But there still are many people within the county who are in a split estate situation.
If leases are signed with people who have the mineral rights and who own the land and own the rights, what leverage does anybody else, any other resident in Mora County, have?
Well, we have a development guidance system, our DGS, which is the ordinance for Mora County. It was put together by some very forward-thinking people who were in the commission and planning and zoning back in the middle 1990s. They adopted the development guidance system, and within that, it states that any industry that would be a prohibited use if they contaminated our water, our air, or impacted human health. So along with that, there are guidelines for what is appropriate and what is considered possible in Mora County. Now, the first thing that it states in our comprehensive land use plan is that you can't prohibit someone from using their land as they want to use it, which would, of course, apply to leasing their mineral rights. But the second point there states that you can't do something that would negatively impact the landowner next to you. So we're looking at an issue of what is socially responsible. And the laws that are on the books right now that are the federal laws that are giving the oil and gas industries all their power are an extension from the law from 1872, the Mining Act of 1872. That was all hard rock mining, but it also included oil and gas development. And then in 1920, a new law that gave oil and gas regulations all of their power was put into place. So we're looking at archaic laws that don't have any environmental or human or animal responsibilities. So Mora County went ahead of what the federal laws stated, and they put into place a law that said you must be socially responsible because Mora County is an agricultural county. So we are betwixt and between a very difficult rock wall here, because laws are saying that we cannot protect our health or our family's health or the generations to come. And that's a bit of a dilemma.
When you look to other places in the state and other places in the West where the type of oil and gas drilling that has been planned for Mora County has already taken place, what do you see environmentally?
We see incredible devastation. We had two gentlemen down last month, Chris Velasquez and Gilbert Armenta. Both were in Split Estate. They were also in other documentaries, one by the Sierra Club, Range Wars, and another, Land Out of Time. They came down because they saw that they aren't able to protect their county. The devastation of aborted cattle just due to toxic water and spills onto their land. The toxic air is a result of the hydrocarbons that are emitted on a daily basis. The devastation to the culture that they see in terms of the Hispanic families who once owned land, it's now down to less than 8%. It used to be 43% prior to oil and gas. We're seeing tremendous changes. We look to New York, and of course they are banning oil and gas because their Chesapeake Oil wants to drill in the watershed, and they know with the hydraulic fracturing chemicals that it will just be a matter of time before the water is polluted. So we look at all of the states, Pennsylvania, Texas, Colorado, Wyoming. We look at all of the water testing samples near gas fields, and we see the benzene levels that are that could kill us if we drank from those water wells. We see the devastation, and so we know that we have to be proactive and that we have to keep them out of this county, or we will end up like Texas, or we will end up like San Juan, where San Juan County has the highest cancer rate in the state of New Mexico.
Tell us more about Mora County. What is it like? Who lives there? What do they do?
Well, Mora County was established back some 300 years ago, and people migrated up to this land when it was a part of Mexico. The King of Spain did grant 76 families land under a land grant. And when the United States took over through a war, much of that land was taken from the people. Common lands were stolen. So this part of the country, Mora County, ended up in a situation where, rather than being land rich, they started off with much of their land stolen. And so, in spite of that, their agricultural knowledge and the wealth of their agricultural land, because of its rich fertility and ample water, gave them the capacity to grow huge quantities of vegetables and raise livestock and produce grains, which they then promptly ground into flour. Mora County used to be the breadbasket for Southwest, and the vegetables and flour was taken by train at Fort Union all the way across the country. So Mora County has always been capable of tremendous production, and we're working hard now to bring it back into full production. There are organizations that are beginning to make that a focal point here in the county. And today the people are still working the land, and we're working on certified organic land and involving students, and there is a wonderful mill called the Tepetes Delana Weaving Mill, and they do a tremendous amount of production, and we're working to increase the production there as well.
We're talking to Kathleen Dudley, co-chair of Drilling Mora County. So you are involved in meetings where the people of Mora County and perhaps beyond Mora County are educating themselves and organizing so that their land is not devastated. I take it that these oil and gas companies are showing up at your meetings.
Yes, they are. They are in attendance at all of the commission and planning and zoning meetings, and they did arrive and sat in at the geology meeting that Dr. Andrew Feldman presented, and I found that very interesting. I asked them why they were there, and they said, well, surprisingly, we really don't know much about the geology here. So whether or not that was really true, that was what they told me, and they sat through to the end. So we generally see them on a regular basis and welcome them to our meetings.
When you have an organized county, I mean, we've been through this in Santa Fe County as well, and Galisteo, where there is interest in oil and gas drilling, and then hundreds or thousands of people show up, how does it affect their plans?
Well, that's a really important point. In Mora County, we have 5,100 people, and we have 1,944 square miles of land. So we have a very important piece of the earth that we're working to protect. I have heard, I have read in newspaper articles, both from one of the Tecton fellows, who said that the rowdiness and the emotional responses of the Santa Fe crowd who came out and protested was enough to just keep them from wanting to do any more business in Santa Fe County. I've also read in New York and Pennsylvania that the same thing has occurred, that the people coming out in hundreds and thousands are discouraged these oil and gas drilling companies. They do not want to do work where people are working against them. So that's one of the reasons why we continue with our educational forums, and we continue to build the groundswell of the grassroots, because we believe that that if we can show industry that they are not welcome here, that we do not want them to pollute our water, and that we don't want them to destroy a culture, which we've seen in other counties, such as San Juan County. And we want to have a legacy to leave to the children who are yet not even on this earth, that we will come out in force, and we will work to discourage them from doing business here.
Now, this coming Thursday, the 11th of March, at 6:30 in the evening in Mora, and we can tell people more precisely where it is, Dr. Eric Romero, an anthropologist, will be talking about some of the issues from a cultural as well as an environmental perspective. Talk about some of the things that he is going to be addressing on Thursday.
Well, Dr. Romero has said that, of course, any time people are people of the land, la gente, that any kind of change that occurs that is from the outside, and I'm going to just paraphrase, I'm not quoting, but that people are impacted. Their cultures are modified. Their cultures are shifted. They can be destroyed. So when we look at technology as it advances, it takes a toll on all cultures. And we can look at our own historical relationship throughout our own lives and see some of those changes occurring. I remember growing up when Sundays, even in the small northern Alberta town that I grew up in, where there were many different religions within that town, Sundays were a rather quiet day, and people did go to church, and there wasn't a lot of activity. Retail stores were closed, and today we have retail stores open 24 hours a day, and Sunday is very much the same as Saturday. So we see a change in the cultural relationship just in one generation. And Mora County is like a little bubble. There's a very strong cultural impact here where people are still on the land and bartering. And if you come here, you don't see a gentrification like you see in other counties. So that would be something that would definitely be impacted with huge volumes of money and growth that comes with industry such as natural gas development.
Well, there's two parts of that. On the one hand, a lot of money comes in, but it comes in for a relatively short time. Then, if it's like any place else where there's been oil and gas drilling in the West, a huge mess is made. It's not cleaned up, and nobody in their right mind wants to live there, and gentrification is impossible because land values go way down.
Well, that's true, and one of the things that we do see is that when there are places that are as economically strapped as Mora County has been for so long, it's very rarely that you would see anyone within the county that would make any money. The money does end up going to those that are in the oil and gas business, so the people end up having to suffer through the booms and busts as we see in other parts of the country, such as Rifle, Colorado. And very often what happens is the tax base goes up so high that those that are living here and have been for many generations end up not being able to afford the taxes during the boom time. They have to sell their land, and then the bust time comes, and then the town is completely devastated.
And that's not something that anyone wants to look forward to. Getting back just for a moment to the issue of water, tell us about the availability of water in Mora County at this time. Where does your water come from?
Well, our water comes from various rivers. Obviously, many people, because so many of the people are on rural pieces of land, they have private wells. Of course, there are wells that are shared in more populated areas, such as in the Mora Valley area. But the water, for the most part, is coming from our aquifers. And when Dr. Eric Romero came and spoke, he said that given that the nature of the shale beds and the shale bed methane hydraulic fracturing process, there would be maximum amounts of water necessary each time the well is fractured. So there would be using upwards of 3 million gallons of water each time a fracturing occurred. And some experts have indicated that a gas well can be fractured upwards of 17 times. Dr. Feldman stated that the aquifers in the Las Vegas Basin could not sustain that type of water extraction.
I think that's a very important point to remember, is that it's not just the possibility of the contamination of water, but it's the fact that so very much water is used in the extraction process itself that would otherwise go toward drinking and agricultural water.
That's correct, and many places are now using brine water, and we've seen in Texas where they are drilling for brine water, where there are massive sinkholes that are resulting from that extraction. So industry will try any form of technology to get what they want. Unfortunately, their accountability in terms of the destruction to the environment is not something that is a part of their agenda.
Kathleen Dudley is co-chair of Drilling Mora County. So people are invited to the event on Thursday night. If they want to find out how to get there and how to reach you, what should they do?
Well, one of the things that could be done, they could Google Tapetes de Lana in Mora County, and that's TAPETES DE and then LANA. Otherwise, if you make your way from Santa Fe, you go through Las Vegas, and then you head north on 518, and you run right into Mora. And at Mora, you will find a colorfully painted building on your right, and you will see a sign for the Alpaca Ranch to your right, and the Tepetes de Lana is that building on that corner. If you're coming from Taos, you would come straight down, and you would look for that same sign and those same murals on your left. It's in the center of the town.
Tapetes de Lana, wool tapestries. And what is your number?
It's 575-666-2529, and we have a blog, and that's www.drillingmoracounty.blogspot.com.
Kathleen Dudley, thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, jazz.